Visioneers, Episode 3, The Venture is Launched.
Des, I'm sure the listener is saying, this is a strange story. We've got a thinking room, a silver bridge in the sky, mentors from history, visioneers from nowhere, world leaders to be kidnapped. What's going on here?
Well, you know, we're tackling a rather big subject, how to save the world. It's a rather daunting prospect, and really what's been happening in this first part is that we've been gathering strength, the reader and the listener, all of us as participants. We've been looking for our allies, gathering our mentors around us.
Is this how it should be in real life? Is this kind of symbolic of that?
Yes, you know, I think it is. I believe there's a whole lot of people out there now who are forming into allies and groups to do this kind of thing.
So, did you actually plan it this way?
In the book, well, not at first, but that's how the story started to come out. And in a way, I think I began to tap into what was going on all around me anyway.
Talking about the story, what happens next?
Well, we move now into a real adventure. And what happens is that Mark is chosen as the leader of the Visioneers, and he takes charge, and he moves his people out into the world. And suddenly, then, we get involved in a whole series of strange vignettes.
Yes, I remember them. First, there was Louis Valdez and George Cardinal, and they're standing on a hillside right in the Andes, and they're watching heavily armed soldiers come up the hill, and they think this is an interesting welcoming party. And then secondly, there was Sally Hurst and her pen pal Nicholas Andropov from Moscow, and they were at a rock concert in Vancouver, and suddenly Teresa Romano comes on stage. And then in Paris, General Soulier, Boris Gunther and Sunichi Yakasawa arrive at UNESCO headquarters in Paris, and they're about to launch something at that end. And then there is Irene Henshaw, who meets with Jeremy Hiscox in Scotland, and they get into this car on a dark country road where they're driven by a chauffeur to meet two aristocrats. And in this encounter, they enlist the support of the aristocracy. And then there's this event in Russia where a couple of visioneers, Bill Bates, if I remember correctly.
And Daniel Thomas.
Yeah, those two. And
they were the crazy Welsh poet.
Yes, and they're rowing across this lake, and one of them agrees to be the rower. Do you remember which one was it?
Well, that's Bill Bates. No, it's Daniel Thomas who's rowing, and Bill
right.
Bates says... you a member of the Welsh rowing team? And he says, yes, I'm the only one.
Right. And so, right, and he told them that he had to enter so many events that he got buried last week. I remember that. And they're having this kind of banter. And then they come upon the Russian contingent who is meeting them, and they have this wonderful meal in this cabin up in a Russian farm with strange vegetables and caviar and lots of vodka. And they talk about enlisting the Russian contingent. And then we find ourselves in Tiananmen Square, and Mohammed Hussein is wandering around thinking about the awful events that happened there recently, and into the Forbidden City in China next. And finally, Mark and Esther are in Australia, and they're going to visit Mark's childhood home. And they've driven 100 miles from Brisbane. And Mark hasn't been back in about 25 years, but he suddenly feels a need to go back and to share it with Esther. And so they park the car about 2 kilometers away, and they come by foot on the railway bridge and cut across the iron bark forest. And finally, following the cattle tracks, they come to the old homestead, where they see the house standing about 100 meters further on. And then Mark hurries down the hill to encounter his childhood. And there is the old paling fence rotting away, but still flecked with traces of white paint. He pushes open the rusty iron gate and comes down the path. And everything is smaller than he remembers, because he was only 8 years old when he was there last. And he remembers himself climbing the old pepperina tree and playing on the front lawn with his Kelpie dog, Blue. And the widespread veranda circles the house, and it's sagging now in places, and the weatherboards badly need a coat of paint. But otherwise, the house seems sound enough, and he bounds up the stairs, rushes through all the rooms, empty, of course, but there they are, just as he remembers them. He goes into his own room at the back, tucked in beside the water tank, where it looks out onto the orchard, and he remembers that the sun used to hit there first, and on cold winter mornings he would want to stay in bed, but his mother would soon dig him out with the smell of sausages sizzling for breakfast. The kitchen is the one room that remains unchanged, and Mark tells Esther that his uncle owns the property now and still uses the kitchen when men are down this way to do the various things that that they do around the farm. And there's this old wood stove, and they make tea on it. And he tells her childhood stories of the place. And it's growing late when they leave, and they head off back through the bush the way they came. And on the high ground by the railway tracks, they stop and sit on a clump of large scattered rocks looking over the darkening tableland. And Mark is silent, and Esther comes close to him and says, "Are you thinking about the others?" "Yes," he says. "I feel responsible for them," he tells her. "They're all out there, and none of us knows what's going to be. And it's not a game anymore. No more silver bridges and mountains and a comfortable visioneering room. We've got a wild plan underway," he says. "And for most of it, we can't be sure how it turns out. But," he tells her, "I had to come back here to touch this place again. Somehow his life and soul is tied up here, and it has strange power for him. I thought about it for years," he said, "but it wasn't until I took on the leadership of our project that I felt I had to come back and get myself set for what's to come." And he tells Esther that he wanted her here with them. And they're silent. And Mark suddenly looks at the sky. And he says, "To be part of that sky, Esther, is such a privilege. Every place where the visioneers are, night or day, they're under that sky. And everyone else, too, every living, breathing soul are under that great dome of space. And if only we could grasp the significance of that and put all the other stuff we call life into perspective, we'd be in tune with ourselves." And they wonder if we can find the wisdom for that. And of course, Esther says, "If enough of us can, then they can show the way." And Mark quotes Mao Zedong,
600 million people, strong in unity, firm in principle, can shore up the falling heavens." And so that's what they're on to.
And they fall silent. And Esther says, "You know, you have to send me to Jerusalem." And Mark doesn't want to do that. "But it's my country," she says. "I must go." He says, "I'll join you as soon as things are settled there." And so from that, they go and make their way back to the car. So with all this, Des, with all these little clips of things, what's really going on?
Well, the visioneers are out in the world. And the adventure has begun. Churchill has been watching all of this, and he sums it up nicely when he pops back into the thinking room to watch the developments on television. "We've got this whole round globe of human pig-headedness," he growls. "First, we've got to spread our arms to get hold of the actors. Then we'll squeeze them tight until their eyes start to pop out of their sockets. That's when they'll see things differently. Yes, we've made a good beginning. There are some weak spots yet, but Mark Venture is getting his team in place. The issue now is to move quickly and keep the pressure on. Once the thoroughbred is out of the stable door, you have to get set for the ride. We've got a good hold on the reins. Now we have to grip the beast with our knees and give him some room to run."
And we're getting hints of danger. There were those armed soldiers in Chile. Don't think I forgot about them. And Mark is worried about Esther alone in Jerusalem. Boy, these characters are getting to be real. The adventure story has started, and we wonder what's going to happen next. And we're really starting to care about all this.
Well, that's good, because there's plenty to care about. Now we go back and start to expand each scene a little bit.
Well, it's like a cinema complex, you know, where there's all those movies, and you keep popping in and out of shows to see what's going on or what you'd like to watch.
Yeah, or it's like flicking through television channels, and it seems to me that that's what life seems to be like these days anyway, moving quickly from one thing to another without ever quite finishing.
Well, tell us about some of these scenes.
Well, I'd like to begin with the key one, and this is Louis Valdez and George Cardinal in Chile. You introduced this a moment ago. They have gone to the mission of the Holy Virgin, high up in the mountains, and they've hit on the idea of broadcasting by satellite to get the message of the visioneers out to people very rapidly. And what better way to do that than to shoot the message up and onto a satellite and have it come down? It's really quite a brilliant idea, and it was part of Mark Venture's strategy with them. But there's a threat to their enterprise, and that's the soldiers that you referred to before, because now they're beginning to press and come a little closer. And here's the scene as they come up towards the mission. Father Louis Valdez goes out to meet them. He says, "I'm Father Louis Valdez. Can I help you with something?" He notices that the central figure of the trio is wearing the designation of captain on his shoulder epaulettes. The man's face is hard, a stubble of unshaven beard adding grimness to his expression. "A priest is no help to anyone." The man's voice is pitched hard and sharp. "What are you doing here?" "Well, right now I'm trying to bring some order to these flower beds, but otherwise I'm in charge of the mission." "The mission is closed. It has been for 12 months. I personally shut it down and escorted the priest out. I ask you again, what are you doing here?" "Well, the mission has reopened. I've come with personal instructions from the bishop. I'm sure you'll find everything is in order." "I don't care about your instructions, priest. I don't want you or your mission in my territory. I should have burned it down. This time I will. Who is here with you?" "No one. This is a small place. The church can't afford an assistant." "I heard different, priest. I heard there were two of you, the other one a foreigner." "I had help moving in from the diocese, but I'm alone here to run the mission." The captain nods to the other two soldiers. "Look around," he says curtly. They half smile, half leer at Father Louis, and touch their heels to their horses' flanks. They brush past him at the gate, so close that one of the stirrups bumps his arm. The smell of horse sweat and leather is thick about them. The butts of their high-powered rifles pass by at eye level. One of the soldiers rides up to the front door, dismounts, and goes inside the church. The other deliberately rides his horse over the flowerbed where Father Louis had been working and disappears around the side of the church in the direction of the stone house where George Cardinal is keeping out of sight. The captain pulls a small radio transmitter out of his saddlebag, and the air crackles with static as he calls and listens for a reply. Louis Valdez walks away a little, giving the man space to display his peevish temper. Apparently satisfied, the captain shuts off the radio and returns it to the saddlebag. "You know why I don't like priests, priest? You come in here with your words of brotherly love and better health and education for the poor people down there in the village and out on the farms. You cause unrest. You create a disturbance. I don't like that. I want to keep things just the way they are. That's my job, keeping order. And the best way to do that is to make sure nothing changes. I don't want any troublemaking priests getting under my skin. You understand me, priest?"
"Well, I hear what you're saying," replies Valdez. "But I come only in the name of God and love and peace. Such a mission can bring no harm, only good."
"Shit on your God and love and peace," the soldier retorts, his eyes flashing with hatred that Valdez has seen 1,000 times before. piss on your virgins and your Christ and all the rest of the crap in your religion. I want you out of here, priest, and I will see to it that you go.
Ugh. I didn't like that. The energy in that makes me shiver. Now, you contrast that with Teresa's amazing performance at the rock concert in Vancouver. Who could ever forget that? I'll read it to you now. Teresa Romano has reached the huge sprawling stage in the middle of the domed stadium in Vancouver. The strident, punishing sound of men at war has lifted the audience to fever pitch. This grim-faced group finishes their piece with an electronic explosion of sound and laser light cutting and stabbing into the frenzied spectators, culminating in a mushroom cloud of dry ice and red-orange billowing light on stage. The sound ceases abruptly. The wild-eyed, sweat-soaked performers scurry off stage. Men at war have launched their Armageddon. Silence settles as the symbolism touches the audience. Then out through the angry, billowing cloud on front stage steps the corpulent, motherly figure of Teresa Romano. Six searing spotlights pick her out. She is dressed simply in a plain white evening gown, a single silver pendant flashing at her throat. The audience remains hushed, curious to find out who this woman in white is, who stepped out of the wreathing cloud of death and destruction left by men at war. Unaccompanied, in a clear contralto, like a bell ringing on a distant church steeple, she begins to sing. The melody and words come from deep within the human spirit. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. Was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. As she finishes, the silence among the audience is profound. She opens her arms wide and calls out to them, "Now, my children, sing it with me, with new words for the new age." She speaks the first line, then motions them to join her as she sings it through. Hesitantly, they begin. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that calls to us to hear. We once were lost, but now we're found. The time to come is near. And the final four lines sweep up and fill the stadium as 25,000 eager teenage voices reach for the stars. Amazing grace, our hearts inspire. Show us the way to see our dreams, our hopes, our great desire to grow, to live, to be.
The song ends. Teresa smiles and bows. A crescendo of applause and shouts of approval break out and continue, wave after wave, the audience on its feet stamping and cheering. Teresa, full spotlight, continues to smile and bow and wave, acknowledging the applause. She is joined on stage on either side by Sally Hurst and Nicholas Andropov. Teresa motions for silence. Slowly the cheering subsides as the audience, curious, wants to see what will happen next.
Thank you, Teresa calls. You're so kind. I love you all, my children. My name is Teresa. I am here with my friends Sally and Nick to ask you to join us in the greatest adventure of all time. We want you to join us as visionaries to change the world.
As she speaks, a great arc of lights overhead flash on, spelling out in letters a meter high, Visioneers. Backstage, the event organizers have formed in a hasty huddle. The promoter, red-faced, perspiring, is demanding explanations. What the hell's going on here? Who's that woman out there? Who let her onto the stage? I don't know, sir, replies the MC. She kind of disappeared out of the smoke. Before I knew what was going on, she had everyone singing. It's a hell of an act, though. If I tried to stop it now, the whole place would come down. What's this visioneer stuff, and who put those lights up? The promoter turns his fury on the stage manager.
I don't know, he replies. They're just kind of materialized.
Lights materializing? This woman appearing out of smoke? What kind of a fool do you take me for? I want you to go out there now and get her off the stage.
The leader of Men at War has been listening. I wouldn't try that, fellas, if I was you. The lady, whoever she is, has a message. And those kids out there are paying attention. I suggest you guys shut up and listen, too. You've got a smash hit on your hands. Don't blow it.
Indeed. The audience is now paying rapt attention to Teresa.
There are just a few of us now, but soon, with your help, we can be millions across the world. We have a vision. It's very simple. We see people everywhere, and especially young people like yourselves, banding together, working on projects, each one led by a vision of what you really want to do, projects that are good, that bring joy and happiness. Just imagine. Will you imagine with me? I want you to dare to see how this might be in every city, town, village, out in the country, everywhere you go, in every land, all races, nationalities, and colors, young people like yourselves, just doing good, helpful projects for people to make things as good as they can be, then making them even better. What a difference that would be. Very soon we wouldn't have to worry nearly as much about all the bad things out there, because the good things you were doing would start to take over. It's so simple. It can begin with you, young people. I'll call you my bambinos. I have 5 bambinos at home in Napoli in Italy. Little Maria and Gina and Isabella and Lorenzo and Stefano the eldest. I want them all to grow up in a world that's free and healthy, where the air is clean and the food is good and there's enough for everyone and they have a nice bed to sleep in and can go to school where they can learn how to dream big dreams and how to make them real. And they can all learn to share and listen and work out differences by doing good things together. What a different world that will be. Can you imagine that with me? Because that's where we must start, by seeing it in our mind, by being visionaries, by being the people in the world who stood up one day and said, we want things to be better. And then instead of thinking of all the reasons why they couldn't be better, we thought of all the ways they could. And then we just went out and did them.
Well, needless to say, Teresa is a rousing success. And 25,000 kids go out into the streets of Vancouver eager to be visionaries. And this is the way it sounds from the book. At the end of her performance, Teresa, Sally, and Nicholas have linked hands with the 6 members of Men at War, and behind them in rows are the other performers, glittering and swaying until all the stage and all the audience filling the stadium is a sea of endless motion. And a new beat comes up over the sound system as Teresa, arms extended, head back, leads 25,000 voices in the Song of the Visioneers, first heard in the visioneering room when her own children and friends showed the way.
We are the ones going to the fore. Big ones, little ones, all of us are here. Small world, big world, reaching out to all. Up and upmost, the mighty visioneers.
Over and over the words are sung until, with Teresa leading the way, the performers walk off the stage and the house lights come up and 25,000 young visioneers march out into the streets of Vancouver and into the consciousness of the world, singing their new song.
We are the ones going to the fore. Big ones, little ones, all of us are here. Small world, big world, reaching out to all. Up and upmost, the mighty visioneers.
Wow, that's Vancouver and the kids. But across the world, across the other side of the Atlantic, there's a totally different scene unfolding. And this is where we come back now to UNESCO. And General Soulière has managed to get a 15-minute meeting with the president of this extraordinary session of UNESCO. This man's name is Prince Rupert of Wittgenstein. And Soulière has this opportunity to try to convince him that he should be given the chance to introduce the topic of the visioneers to this assembly of UNESCO. And here's General Soulière talking to Prince Rupert. Thank you, Your Royal Highness. As I said in my communication with your office a few days ago, I would like your assistance in introducing the Visioneering Project to UNESCO's General Assembly. As you've been asked to deliver the opening address to this extraordinary session on New Directions, you have a unique opportunity to launch an enterprise that captures the essence of what UNESCO was established to do. It's been truly said that wars begin in the minds of men. Equally true is that peace and prosperity take root in the visions that people have of the way they wish to live their lives. If we speak of peace but see ourselves fighting to achieve what we want, then there's no truth to our words. Now, I'm a survivor of many campaigns. I fought always for peace, but we never found it. For in the fruits of every victory lie the seeds of the next conflict. It's past time for us to replace destructive thinking with creative thinking. That's the essence of our project.
Yes, but the real thing that will make a difference to UNESCO and the world has just happened on the other side of the Atlantic in Chile. Father Luis Valdez has launched his crusade by satellite. He's not sure who might be listening, friends or enemies.
George Cardinal makes a final adjustment to the small television camera, then looks directly at Luis Valdez. 1 minute from now, you're going to be the most famous Roman Catholic priest in South America, says Cardinal. That's a very dangerous reputation to have in some quarters. It's not too late to choose a disguise. Father Luis smiles, shakes his head. If I can't stand full face in declaring our beliefs, the project will be the weaker for it. It must be this way. Okay, but let's hope that captain isn't watching. Stand by for cue. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You're on.
Speaking softly in Spanish, the sad-eyed priest begins to transmit his message. It's going out via satellite from which it can be picked up and rebroadcast in 1,000 different ways across the continent. They've made what arrangements they could for broadcast to be transmitted by networks in various countries, but there are no guarantees or controls in this wild and disparate land.
Luis Valdez begins to speak. My friends, if you're watching this, it will be because someone with a little power or influence believes you should. Perhaps before I'm finished, the transmission will be interrupted. If that happens, I hope you'll be resourceful to find out what someone else believed you shouldn't hear. I don't know when or how I may speak to you again, but I can assure you that what I'm about to say will soon be a force abroad in the world, and if you seek actively to become a part of it, the opportunity for you to do so will be found. My name is Father Luis Valdez. I speak to you on behalf of the Visioneers. We are a group of 20 ordinary people from many countries who have come together on an enterprise to change the future of the world. That may sound like a bold and ridiculous statement, except that all actions from the past which have changed the course of history began in the minds of a few people who decided to act on their ideas. In some cases, those ideas were wicked and corrupt, and they brought misery and death to countless millions of people. In most cases, the ideas were magnificent, and the world prospered greatly from them. In all instances, vision preceded action, and action was carried forward through courage and determination.
Now, Luis Valdez continues to speak and brings in the subject of people being ignorant of a basic law of the universe. The ignorance, my friends, is not understanding that all life is interconnected. Not knowing that if you have a problem, then it's also my problem. And if I have a problem, it's also your problem. From that realization comes an amazing truth. I can have well-being only if you have well-being. My prosperity depends on your prosperity. If either of us acts as if this isn't so, we work against the basic law of the universe, and we ultimately bring destruction, if not on our own heads, then on those who follow, who will eventually suffer when the slack that's in the system which preserved me from the consequences of my actions is all used up. My friends, the world is now coming dangerously close to running out of slack in the system. The human race is now multiplying too rapidly, and acting too aggressively for the natural system of which we're all a part to continue to support us. We must now take care and learn new frames of mind for the new millennium. The Visioneers are calling upon you, wherever you are, whatever your status, to come together with whoever you can to build shared visions of the future. Begin small with your family and your neighbors in your community. See in your minds the conditions in the future that you wish to create, and then begin to widen it out, to test it against the vision of others, to refine it, to change it, and to continuously learn how to do this, because we have no choice now but to learn how to create a sustainable future for all of us. You must demand from yourselves first, then from your employers and your authorities, your teachers, your priests, from everyone you must demand the right to think in this way. It's a new kind of learning. It's creative learning. It's the only kind of learning that can save us from ourselves. My time is almost gone. If you have seen this broadcast, act now. Call your television station. Ask them to repeat it. Take responsibility for acting to begin the process. Don't accept the old ways of conflict and aggression. My friends, the future requires that all of us work together to win, or ultimately we will all lose together. We have beautiful and miraculous minds which, if we choose to use their potential, can touch the mind of God. The time for us to do so is at hand. Go forward, my friends. Join us as visioneers and look for the signs of the transformation all around you. God bless you, and goodbye until I can speak to you again. As he finishes speaking from the cramped transmission room in the Mission of the Holy Virgin, high in the Andes, Luis Valdez looks across to George Cardinal. The burly Cree Indian chief had automatically flicked the switch to end the broadcast and now sits staring at his friend in silence. "Well," asks Valdez, "what do you think?"
"I think," Cardinal's voice is choked with emotion, "you may have started the rebirth of civilization. You were inspired. If only the whole world could have heard it."
"The world will hear it," says Valdez. "The play's begun, and the curtain will never come down again. Now I have a great need to pray. Will you come with me to the church?"
What?
Silently, the two visioneers leave the house and walk over to the church, standing square and firm against the Andean skyline.
Well, that's really powerful. Can you imagine the impact of anyone who just suddenly tuned in and heard that out of nowhere? And this has a particular impact in UNESCO, where Prince Rupert plays a copy for the delegates. This is a really extraordinary thing to do. Does you know about UNESCO? Is this what would happen?
Well, it's billed as an extraordinary session, and I guess Prince Rupert is taking the lead on that and acting in an extraordinary way, so perhaps it is possible.
So the delegates at the UNESCO conference hear this, and at the end they are so moved that they applaud the visionaries, and the visionaries are recognized by the assembly, and finally the world begins to pay attention.
Yes, in just a few hours, visionaries have suddenly become a force in the world, and it just shows what can happen if people decide to act and use the creative power of their imagination to do so.